This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Excitement builds over a potential COVID-19 vaccine. Now the big question, who gets it first? Rich countries are investing in equal access, but also reserving doses for themselves.
In some sense, they are sort of giving with one hand and taking away with the other.
I'm Carol Hills. News surfaces that a top Al-Qaeda leader was killed on a street in Tehran this summer.
He was involved in everything that Al-Qaeda has been doing.
And China has brought together 15 Asian countries in one of the biggest free trade pacts ever.
Now, with China taking a lead in this organization, it's clear it's going to really solidify their power in the region.
Where that leaves the U.S. and other stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World on this Monday. Promising news from the pharma company Moderna today. They announced preliminary data showing their coronavirus vaccine to be 94.5% effective. Pfizer announced some similar results last week. That means there's an increased urgency in addressing how and to whom vaccines will be distributed once they're ready. Andrea Taylor is with Duke University's Global Health Innovation Center, where she's studying global data on COVID-19 vaccines and therapeutics. Andrea, first of all, I want to start with asking you about the Pfizer and Moderna announcements last week and today. What was your reaction when you heard about these results?
So obviously, they're really good news. I think the Pfizer vaccine in particular is good news for high-income countries and not really good news for lower-income countries that may lack the infrastructure to deal with an ultra-cold storage vaccine. So the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine candidate needs to be stored at about negative 70 degrees Celsius, but the same temperature as dry ice. So in that context, the Moderna news is very welcome for countries that lack the ultra-cold storage capacity. And the Moderna vaccine, it's stable at refrigeration temperatures and can be frozen at standard freezer temperatures for up to 6 months.
When should we be expecting the first vaccines to be distributed for public use at this point?
It looks like the first vaccines will likely ship out about mid-December, and those will be going to the highest priority populations, which will include frontline healthcare workers and those at the highest risk of mortality from COVID-19.
And will those be going to basically rich countries or frontline workers and those at most risk across the globe?
That is the million-dollar question. The majority of the doses that have been purchased through advanced market commitments have been purchased by high-income countries. What we don't know is of those first tranches of doses that get manufactured, where they will ship out. So the COVAX facility is currently the only mechanism we have globally to ensure that vaccines go to all countries at the same time in the same proportion.
And remind us what the COVAX facility is. What's that whole mechanism?
Sure. So the COVAX facility is an alliance with WHO, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and CEPI. It's a mechanism to ensure that there is global equity of access in vaccines. So countries can join the COVAX facility and buy in at a certain percentage of their population. Then the COVAX is reserving manufacturing capacity to ensure that the successful candidates can be manufactured, and then we'll ship them out to all participating COVAX countries proportional to the population so that all COVAX member countries will get up to 20% coverage. And then countries that have bought in at a higher level can then receive additional population coverage, but every country will receive at least 20% population coverage before any country gets more.
But the long and short of it is all depends on – it's not going to preclude the high-income countries who've already contracted to get a whole bunch of vaccines from company X or Y to go ahead and distribute those vaccines.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And that's what our research is really looking at, is that there are these competing incentives, particularly for high-income countries, where these high-income countries, many of them have invested really generously in COVAX and in global equity, and at the same time are reserving doses through advanced market commitments. And because of the manufacturing constraints, reserving doses through advanced market commitments actually takes doses off of the table. So in some sense, they are sort of giving with one hand through their investments in COVAX and taking away with the other through their advanced market commitments.
Hmm. What are your chief concerns when it comes to distribution?
The primary concerns that we're looking out for are certainly preparedness in terms of having trained providers in the right locations, having the syringes that are needed, because those need to ship ahead. Those need to go by sea, whereas the vaccines can go by air. But we're also very concerned about a couple issues that we're hearing more and more about from experts on the ground. So one of those is around vaccine hesitancy and misinformation and mistrust of the vaccines, this sort of rise in anti-vaccine campaigns globally. So we're seeing that pop up more and more, even in lower income countries. There is a concern that there will be a lack of demand, actually, once vaccines are available. And then another concern that we have is vaccine fraud, potential issues of vaccines and fraudulent vaccines being offered on a black market. And I think when we are looking at the equity issues, if we have low-income countries that are struggling to reserve and receive enough vaccine doses to protect their population, they will be more vulnerable than to a vaccine black market and potentially receiving vaccines that are fraudulent.
Andrea Taylor is with Duke University's Global Health Innovation Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The prospect of an effective COVID-19 vaccine is exciting, but a vaccine alone won't end the pandemic. That's what the director of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, stressed today during the agency's daily briefing. Tedros said any vaccine must go hand in hand with other public health measures, testing, tracing, isolating, and supporting those who need to quarantine.
My message is very clear. Act fast. Act now. Act decisively. A laissez-faire attitude to the virus, not using the full range of tools available, leads to death, suffering, and hurts livelihoods and economies.
That message of taking a comprehensive approach has hit close to home for the agency itself. Tedros went into self-quarantine this month after coming into contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. He was back at WHO headquarters in Geneva for the first time today and said he feels fine. The organization also confirmed today that five of its on-site staff members tested positive in the past week. WHO Emergency Director Dr. Mike Ryan said that Switzerland, where the agency is based, has been a hotspot for the coronavirus in Europe.
We are human beings and we live within a society and we're not entirely within a cocoon here.
WHO's technical director, Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, said it's reduced the number of staff on site and is tracing the path of infections.
So what we do is we carry out contact tracing to see who they came in contact with, to see if there are any further onward transmission, as most countries are doing. But we also look back to see what did they do in the previous 14 days, for example.
Kerkhove said since the start of the pandemic, three dozen staff based at the WHO have tested positive for COVID, but all are now fine. Worldwide, more than 50 million cases have been reported and more than 1.3 million people have died. Boris Johnson's first year as British Prime Minister has been a rocky one. There's the pandemic, Johnson's own battle with COVID-19, never-ending Brexit talks, and political U-turns on everything from free school meals to a nationwide lockdown. Through it all, Johnson has had his chief advisor, Dominic Cummings, by his side. Last Friday, that partnership ended abruptly, leaving many wondering what's next for the Prime Minister and for Brexit. From London, the world's Orla Barry has more.
Dominic Cummings achieved what few advisers to any UK Prime Minister have done. He's become a household name in Britain. Cummings did so as the chief architect behind the Vote Leave campaign, persuading voters to say yes to Brexit in 2016.
We can now say the decision taken in 1975 by this country to join the common market has been reversed by this referendum. The British people have spoken and the answer is we're out.
The news was a stunning political development that Cummings largely orchestrated. When the Conservatives won a majority in last December's election, he got credit for that too. And for the campaign slogan that secured Boris Johnson this landslide victory.
Good morning, everybody, my friends. Well, we did it. We did it. We pulled it off, didn't we? And with this mandate and this majority, we will at last be able to do what? We've been paying attention.
Johnson rewarded Cummings with the top job as his chief advisor. And the move upset a lot of people because Cummings is a notoriously abrasive figure with a knack for rubbing people up the wrong way. For those who oppose Brexit, Cummings is despised. But in Johnson's own Conservative Party, Cummings has plenty of enemies too.
His style was abrasive and combative and involved attacking institutions in a way that was very unconservative.
That's David Gawke, a former Justice Secretary with the party, speaking to the BBC. His colleague, MP Charles Walker, says Cummings cut off access to the Prime Minister.
We feel we've lost him for the last year. We want him back. He belongs to us. He doesn't belong to the advisers. He belongs to the parliamentary party that elected him.
But despite the dissent from his party colleagues, Boris Johnson remained fiercely loyal to his closest aide. Most memorably, when Cummings flouted national lockdown rules by driving to his parents' home in another part of England and then taking a day trip to a local castle while suffering with COVID symptoms. Cummings was forced to give a press conference to try and explain his actions.
My wife was very worried, particularly given my eyesight had seemed to have been affected by the disease. We agreed that we should go for a short drive to see if I could drive safely. We drove for roughly half an hour and ended up on the outskirts of Barncastle town.
His explanation did not go down well with the British public or many Conservative MPs. But despite all the outrage, the Prime Minister refused to sack Cummings. Matthew Flinders, Professor of Politics at Sheffield University, says it's not just about loyalty.
Boris, as a character, is somebody who needs to be loved. And actually, what you had with Boris and Dominic Cummings was the most strangest sort of good cop, bad cop political partnership. That basically Dominic Cummings was there to ruffle feathers, to be disruptive. Often that had to happen to shake things up. But Boris was never going to do that.
Which makes Cummings' sudden departure from 10 Downing Street on Friday all the more intriguing. Some are convinced that Johnson's trusty aide finally turned against him. But apart from all the intrigue, many wonder what Cummings' departure will mean for the Brexit talks. With this hardline Brexiteer no longer at his side, might Boris Johnson agree to compromise and strike a deal with the EU? Matthew Flinders doesn't think so.
Now there are so many big, big areas where there is no agreement at all. It's hard to see, even with Dominic Cummings out of the way, whether there could be any agreement. And actually, the person who is strongest and most sort of bitten into not negotiating is Boris. So no, I don't think there's going to be any sudden rapid shift in European policy.
But former Prime Minister Gordon Brown says a deal could be on the cards. Speaking on national television, he says it's less about Dominic Cummings and more about who's moving into the White House.
I think the arrival of Joe Biden has made all the difference. I see a trade deal coming pretty soon. The government simply cannot afford to be at war with America on the one hand and Europe on the other at the start of the new year.
With Cummings gone, there's an expectation that a new, softer tone might emerge from 10 Downing Street. More congenial, less confrontational. But what of Boris Johnson himself? Without his right-hand man, is his future as Prime Minister on shaky ground? Matthew Flinders says this is a critical moment for Johnson.
Boris's main weakness has always been himself. That's why every election he's bid into, his advisers and the team around him have basically focused more on hiding Boris away than of promoting him out there.
Flinders says the Prime Minister now has to rebuild public trust with a new team of advisers. Today, Johnson is back in quarantine after a fellow MP he met with tested positive for the coronavirus. He has to self-isolate for 14 days. Perhaps this will give Boris Johnson the time he needs to plan his next move. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Coming up soon, China's new trade deal deepens its power across Asia. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. One of al-Qaeda's top leaders was killed back in August, gunned down on a street in Tehran. That's according to unnamed U.S. intelligence officials in news reports over the weekend. He was known as Abu Muhammad al-Masri and was number two at al-Qaeda. According to reports, Israeli operatives killed al-Masri and his daughter in Iran's capital. Iranian officials are denying the reports. They also deny that the country gives safe harbor to al-Qaeda terrorists. The World's Shirin Jafari has the story.
Iran is not the first place you would expect an al-Qaeda leader to be living in. The Islamic Republic is a Shia-majority country. Al-Qaeda is a Sunni militant group. And the two have long been bitter enemies. But according to American officials, last August, Israeli operatives carried out a brazen assassination in the heart of Iran's capital.
Story coming from West Asia, where al-Qaeda's second chief in command was killed in Iran 3 months ago.
Intelligence officials told the New York Times it happened around 9 p.m. local time. Two men on a motorcycle approached the car of a man believed to be al-Qaeda's second in command, Abu Muhammad al-Masri. The men fired five shots using guns fitted with silencers. Four of them hit al-Masri and his daughter, who was with him in the car. This witness told Iranian news media that neighbors found the two bodies shortly after. Initially, the victims were identified as a Lebanese history teacher, Habib Daoud, and his 27-year-old daughter, Maryam. But reporters were never able to verify those names. American intelligence officials say Iran was trying to cover up the assassination. U.S. intelligence officials took notice of Abu Muhammad al-Masri back in 1998. He helped plan the twin attacks on American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Al-Masri was born in Egypt and was a professional soccer player. But later, he was drawn into the fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan and to the type of extremism that Osama bin Laden was promoting. Barak Mendelson has studied jihadi movements for the past two decades.
He was involved in everything that al-Qaeda has been doing, whether it's as a trainer in Somalia, actually involved in a way in the Black Hawk Down incident. And over time, as the al-Qaeda bench emptied out, he found himself suddenly in the position of number two in al-Qaeda.
Mendelson says al-Masri has lived in Iran since 2002, and the country's relationship with the group has been complicated. After 9/11, members of al-Qaeda showed up in Iran. Initially, it wasn't clear who was letting them in. But Asaf Moghaddam, with the Lauder School of Government, Diplomacy and Strategy in Herzliya, Israel, says the connection between Iran and al-Qaeda grew into something transactional.
Over time, it became a bit more clear. And it really turned out that the Iranians were holding the al-Qaeda operatives to use them as kind of a cudgel, so to speak.
If high-level al-Qaeda officials were living in Iran, he says, maybe the group would think twice before carrying out an attack on the country. Iran also saw al-Qaeda members as bargaining chips. In 2011, for example, it released members of the bin Laden family in exchange for an Iranian diplomat who was abducted in Pakistan. Asaf Moghaddam says he wasn't surprised about the news of the Israeli-led assassination in Iran. There have been others in the past. And he says the killing of Abu Muhammad al-Masri comes at a time when there are reports of the death of another top al-Qaeda leader.
If this is true, then you basically have a 1-2 punch against the al-Qaeda leadership, for which it will be very, very difficult for the group to recover.
Experts say al-Qaeda Central has been in decline for a while, but its affiliates continue to wreak havoc in parts of Africa, the Middle East and South Asia. They also point out that the killing of al-Masri took place 22 years to the day of the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The U.S. remains the world's largest economy, but just barely. During the next 4 years, China's GDP is expected to overtake the U.S., with India not far behind. One reason why is global trade. China is the world's most dominant trading partner. And that's a trend that's received another boost this weekend. China brought together more than a dozen countries across the Asia-Pacific region to sign a huge free trade deal. Here to tell us what that might mean is Kara Reynolds. She's a professor of economics at American University. Kara, who is in this new trade group and how important is it?
Yeah, so this partnership includes China, Japan, South Korea, Australia and New Zealand, and all 10 members of the original Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which includes Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, Brunei, Cambodia, Myanmar, and Laos. It's a big deal. Between all the countries, it accounts for about a third of the world's population and about 29% of the world's GDP.
Now, it sounds like a mega deal. Still, some have called its value more symbolic than actual. I mean, India is not a member. Will this group dominate global trade in the years to come?
India was part of the initial negotiations for this, so I think it is possible that they may join later on. The ASEAN nations that I mentioned already had free trade within them, and they also had free trade agreements with Australia and New Zealand and China. But this is the first free trade agreement that is between China, Japan, and South Korea.
What exactly is China's role, and will it call the shots in the group or simply back it?
You know, initially, the United States and most of these countries were negotiating part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that agreement was specifically designed to exclude China in some ways, to give the countries bargaining power with China, to encourage them to change some of their regulations. And so now, with China taking a lead in this organization, it's clear it's going to really solidify their power in the region, certainly economically, but I think it could have political repercussions as well.
What does this mega deal mean for the U.S. economy? I mean, it's used to being the 800-pound gorilla where trade's concerned, and now it's kind of on the sidelines.
I agree. And so what you would expect to see is exports from the United States to the area to actually fall as this agreement is solidified. I mean, it's also unfortunate that the United States didn't have a seat at the table to talk about some of the issues that are part of this agreement other than just tariffs, things like intellectual property rights, financial services, and e-commerce. These were all of the top issues that were in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Act, actually, that we had firm beliefs on what they should include, and we weren't even part of these discussions.
I was just going to mention the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was something President Obama tried to set up as a rival trade initiative, and President Trump withdrew the U.S. from that effort. President Biden, once he's in office, could try to revive it. What challenges would he face?
I think even President Obama had challenges getting support for the TPP domestically in Congress. So President Biden is going to face the same types of challenges. There's just not a lot of desire for new free trade initiatives in the United States right now.
Why aren't trade deals popular right now in the U.S.?
Oh, that is a million-dollar question. I personally feel that it has a lot to do with income inequality and people feeling that globalization has done certain segments of the U.S. society wrong in terms of lowering wages, particularly amongst certain skill levels in this country.
Kara Reynolds is a professor of economics at American University. Thanks a lot, Kara.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is The World. The argument for a four-day work week gets a pandemic-era makeover.
I don't think many people will find it surprising to know that
when you're overworked and burnt out, you become demotivated and don't do as well as a job.
And one of the world's most important telescopes is in peril.
At this moment, with the information that we have, the structure is not safe.
Ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. As the U.S. finds itself at a crossroads between one president and another, the United Nations happens to be conducting its regular review of the United States human rights record. It does this every 4.5 years with each of its 193 member states. This time around, the Trump administration is using the review as a final platform to defend its America First approach. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
We will now proceed with the review of the United States of America.
This is the U.S.'s third Universal Periodic Review. It's supposed to be a rare opportunity for member countries to evaluate each other on progress toward the global body's founding principles of human rights. The result is a set of recommendations by the evaluating countries. And while those recommendations aren't enforced, Nicoleta Zapile's group did a study that shows they're surprisingly effective. She's with UPR Info in Geneva.
Over 50% of
UPR recommendations trigger an action. Steps are taken to implement those recommendations.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam President.
In his presentation to the UN, U.S. Ambassador Andrew Brennberg portrayed the Trump administration as a human rights champion. He highlighted the steps the Trump administration has taken to protect religious liberty by creating an international religious freedom alliance with a joint declaration in support of defending life and protecting the family.
As we witness a time of unprecedented degradation of human rights by authoritarian governments around the world, it is more important than ever to stand up to defend human rights and fundamental freedoms.
Brennberg said the Trump administration welcomes transparency and constructive criticism. Joanne Camiff Ward says that's how the Trump administration would like to be remembered, despite reality. She's director of the Human Rights in the U.S. Project at Columbia Law School.
There has been this ongoing narrative by Trump that the U.S. remains a global human rights leader, while at the same time we've seen the exact opposite.
We shall now begin the interactive dialogue.
Representatives from the evaluating countries talked fast. They only had a minute each, and often said, with all due respect, before picking the Trump administration's narrative apart, listing the many ways the U.S. doesn't live up to its human rights obligations. Russia mentioned a big one, the Trump administration's withdrawal from the UN Human Rights Council.
The decision of the U.S. to withdraw from the Human Rights Council showed once again the U.S. reluctance to have a civilized dialogue with the global community on human rights.
Countries also talked about the U.S.'s ongoing use of the death penalty and its failure to combat housing discrimination, to sign international human rights agreements, and to provide universal health care, especially during the COVID pandemic. India recalled the need to address the gender pay disparity
and ensure equal pay for work or equal value at workplaces.
Croatia talked about the U.S. failure to combat gun violence
and implement regulations with the aim of removing the so-called gun show loophole.
Others suggested steps to address hate speech, violence against LGBTQ people, and climate change. They asked the U.S. to close Guantanamo, rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, and lift sanctions on members of the International Criminal Court. Mexico highlighted the detention conditions for migrants.
Ensure the conditions appropriate to detention centers, prioritize family unity, and safeguard the best interests of the child.
Nearly all the countries recommended that the U.S. take steps to investigate and punish police misconduct. Argentina mentioned George Floyd by name.
Including measures to prevent murders such as that of George Floyd and to ensure that justice is brought when these occur.
Conservatives see the recommendations as inherently flawed because they believe the UN is biased and politicized, says Brett Schaefer at the Heritage Foundation. He questions a Human Rights Council that includes members accused of gross human rights violations, like China.
For countries with such serious human rights problems to be so easily elected to sit on the Human Rights Council tells you a lot about how seriously other member states take the issue of human rights and the desire that they have to actually advance human rights standards and principles in an objective way.
The Trump administration responded to some of the recommendations, saying that there are no plans to shut Guantanamo and that unchecked migration is dangerous. They said the George Floyd protests this summer led to lawlessness. This was James McCammond, Deputy Undersecretary at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, at the review.
It was with alarm and disbelief this year that we saw violent anarchists, violent opportunists, and criminals set fire to many U.S. communities, kill innocent people, assail private property, and target our law enforcement officers.
Joanne Camiff Ward of Columbia Law School's Human Rights Institute says ultimately the Trump administration's attempt to rewrite history won't matter because its successor, the Biden administration, will have to deal with reality.
It will be really important when we have a new administration to be prepared with some really concrete and measurable action that's aligned, again, with the globally recognized norms.
The Biden administration will ultimately be the one to accept or reject the recommendations, since the U.S. has until March 2021 to consider them. And Camiff Ward says they'll provide an important roadmap for the new president as he plans to rejoin the Human Rights Council and the global community. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Fighting in the northern Tigray region of Ethiopia continues to escalate and has now hit neighboring Eritrea. Yesterday, the leader of Tigray's forces confirmed they had fired rockets at the airport in Eritrea's capital over the weekend, and he threatened that more will come. The escalation raises fears of a wider war in the Horn of Africa region. Ahmed Solomon is a research fellow on the Horn of Africa at the London-based Chatham House. So, Ahmed, so far we've seen the recent violence in northern Ethiopia limited within the country's borders. How did Eritrea get involved?
The Eritrean government have been accused by the Tigrayan leadership, the regional leader, Debretsion Gebremichael, of getting involved in the conflict, of supporting the federal government in its military operations in the Tigray region, providing support on the border in terms of both forces as well as shelling into Tigray. And what you have there is a region which has seen cyclical conflict over a number of decades, and in some ways is still feeling the aftershocks of the war, a quite costly war in 1998 to 2000, between Ethiopia and Eritrea. That really cemented the hatred between the current Tigrayan leaders and the current Eritrean leaders. That continues today.
I want to take a step back. Remind us what caused the recent violence to erupt in the Tigray region.
So we had a fairly fraught relations for some time between the regional administration in Tigray and the federal government. Particularly since Abiy Ahmed came into power, tensions have worsened.
Abiy Ahmed is the current president of Ethiopia who famously won the Nobel Prize last year.
Yes, Abiy Ahmed is the current prime minister of Ethiopia who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019 for his efforts at initiating peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea after 20 years. And also for trying to initiate broad reforms and opening of freedoms and you know, political space in the country since 2018. Relations between the federal government under Abiy and the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, worsened. I think the TPLF had been pretty much within the ethnic federal government, the leading partner for over 27 years. And really, when Abiy came in on the back of widespread protests in the country for a number of years, that changed. And the TPLF had to retreat to the regional capital, and a new power dynamic took hold in Ethiopia. Since there have been deterioration of relations between the two. And since then, really, both parties have worked to delegitimize each other short of open conflict. And we led to a situation where, because of COVID-19, national elections that were due to be held in August were postponed. And that complicated that political tension that was resented in Tigray. They went ahead and held their own unilateral elections, which were unconstitutional. They refused to recognize the federal government's legitimacy. And in turn, the prime minister and the government in Addis Ababa denounced the Tigrayan elections. They cut ties with the regional administration and withheld federal budget subsidies to the region as well. So you see how things have spiraled.
From your vantage point, what is needed here to avoid this conflict from gathering steam across the Horn of Africa?
I think, you know, what we've seen is that from a regional security and diplomatic perspective, Ethiopia really is a bit too big to fail. I think, you know, we've had considerable international concern and statements in that regard, but we need coordinated diplomatic efforts and demands for a truce. And I think the United States, as well as the United Kingdom, are two of Ethiopia's largest bilateral donors and are well positioned really to influence and to put their concerns forward as members of the international community. I think what is needed is for both sides to moderate their extreme demands in order to be able to come to the negotiating table. And particularly on the US side, I know that there is a transition ongoing at the moment and a lot of internal focus in U.S. politics. But I think by bipartisan backing that we've been seeing, and a strong message also from President-elect Biden, would be influential and could potentially reverse some of the damage done to U.S.-Ethiopia relations that we saw under President Trump.
Ahmed Solomon is a research fellow on the Horn of Africa at the London-based Chatham House. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brazilians voted in local elections in more than 5,500 municipalities across the country this weekend. The biggest takeaway? It was another setback for President Jair Bolsonaro. And it comes on the heels of the electoral loss of his top ally, U.S. President Donald Trump. Michael Fox has more from Brazil.
Reitere o Brasil dos assassinos e bandidos dos milicianos.
If that voice sounds a little familiar, it's because you've heard it before. Just not in Portuguese.
Voce Monica Benicio.
That's Pink Floyd's Roger Waters telling Brazilians to, quote, free the country from the murderers and the thieves and vote for Monica Benicio. She's the widow of the late black city councilwoman Marielle Franco, whose killing in 2018 sparked nationwide protests and a Black Lives Matter movement in Brazil. Roger Waters' appeal may have helped. Benicio won a city council seat in Sunday's local elections, receiving nearly 23,000 votes. She's considered the first openly lesbian Rio de Janeiro city council member. She's one of a series of LGBTQ candidates who won around Brazil, including two trans women who garnered some of the highest numbers of votes in Sao Paulo.
At the same time we had, I think this election was the largest numbers of LGBTs running here in Brazil.
That's Marta Dalla Chiesa. She's the former president of the Brazilian LGBT Tourism Association. She says it seems LGBT candidates did well despite Bolsonaro's openly homophobic slurs and rhetoric, which the president was spouting even last week.
I think we do have a bit more understanding in the society that moved on from him, despite all his rhetoric.
It may be a sign of Bolsonaro's waning influence.
Se Deus quiser, não digo na posse, né? Mas ela é eleita, eu apareço lá em janeiro para cumprimentá-la.
Ou então no segundo turno, presidente.
That is Bolsonaro during a Facebook Live event on November 12th, encouraging supporters to vote for numerous candidates. Most of those candidates lost. In Sao Paulo, Bolsonaro's guy came in a dismal fourth place after leading early polls. One centrist party openly rejected Bolsonaro's support for a mayoral candidate in a city in northern Brazil, saying it was unwise considering what was happening to candidates identified with Bolsonaro. That candidate also came in fourth. Jacques Mick is a political scientist at the Federal University of Santa Catarina. Jacques says, it seems Bolsonaro has lost his charismatic political power. 2020 has squashed the popularity of the president, which should increase the political difficulties for Bolsonaro for the coming years, ahead of the 2022 presidential elections. It doesn't help that Bolsonaro no longer has a party. He left his social liberal party late last year with plans to form a new far-right party, which he called Alliance for Brazil. But he couldn't get it registered fast enough to compete in this year's elections. That didn't dissuade dozens of supporters from trying to cash in on his name. On Saturday, a candidate named Rafa Bolsonaro supporters held an hour-long Facebook Live event from the back of a pickup truck. He was part of a caravan riding in support of his campaign for city council in a hillside town near Rio de Janeiro. In the video, he wears a blue shirt with the silhouette of Bolsonaro's face etched across the front. He was one of more than 40 candidates registered to run in local elections with Bolsonaro in their names. Brazilians are allowed to include their nicknames on the ticket. There was even a Donald Trump Bolsonaro in a small town in southern Brazil, though a local electoral court disqualified him from running because he couldn't prove that he was actually known by that name. A lot of these Bolsonaro-linked candidates did not do well. Bolsonaro's own son, Carlos, was re-elected to Rio City Council, but with 35,000 less votes than in 2016. That, however, doesn't mean the country's political right is losing speed. Here's political scientist Jacques Mick again.
Embora esse ícone da direita, o presidente da República, tenha sido derrotado, quer dizer, as escolhas dele não foram bem-sucedidas.
He says, even though the icon of the right, President Bolsonaro, has been defeated or his candidates did not do well, in general, the right is well-positioned, with even more robust compositions than the left at this moment. But the election wasn't a blowout for the right. The Workers' Party held ground. The Progressive Socialism and Liberty Party, PSOL, which grew out of the Workers' Party in the early 2000s, picked up important seats across the country, and it tripled its city council members in Sao Paulo. Oh. supporters cheered for PSOL mayoral candidate Guillermo Bolos, the leader of the homeless workers movement, after he voted on Sunday. Bolos is headed for a runoff with center-right incumbent mayor Bruno Covas. Bolos has been on the receiving end of a campaign of attacks and fake news looking to smear his reputation. So has Manuela Dávila, a young, charismatic Communist Party candidate who is also headed for a mayoral runoff election in Porto Alegre, the southernmost state capital. For all of you listeners, she told supporters last week, I'm so sorry that you have been victims of this campaign of so many attacks, so many lies, so much disqualification, and so much machismo. This is political gender violence. That's what us women call what I am being subjected to. Manuela is fairly high profile. She was the vice presidential candidate for the left against Bolsonaro in 2018. Last week, a regional court ordered that 91 links to false claims about her be taken down from social media sites. It's a sign that even if Bolsonaro's influence is waning, the smear tactics that were rolled out in his presidential campaign and used by the far right are still being employed, and they're likely to continue as Brazilians look toward the runoff elections later this month and to 2022, when Bolsonaro will do his best to win a second term. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
You rely on The World for a daily dose of global connection. Need just a little more? Sign up for our newsletter, The Top of the World. That's at theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. If you've got a case of the Monday blues, this next story is for you. A group of left-leaning politicians and labor organizations have sent an open letter to leaders of the EU, as well as President-elect Joe Biden. Their demand? A four-day work week. They argue that switching to a four-day work week has environmental and mental health benefits and could potentially help countries recover from the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Joe Ryle is a campaigner at 4-Day Week UK, one of the signatories of the letter. First of all, Joe, when we say a 4-day work week, what are we talking about? Is it people working 40 hours but longer days, just 4 days, or fewer working hours overall?
It's fewer working hours overall. So we're campaigning for a 4-day working week, which would be about 32 hours. At the moment, on average, workers in the US and UK are working around 40 hours, which hasn't changed very much since about the 1980s. So we're long overdue a change. And what we've seen is that this new era that we're in, of greater automation and new technology, part of that was we were promised that it was going to allow us to have more free time on our hands. That hasn't actually happened. So it's about time we all worked a bit less to share work more equally across the economy.
But it would also involve less money, wouldn't it? I mean, wouldn't people have to take a pay cut?
No, so we're campaigning for a 4-day week with no reduction in pay for workers. And where most organisations and businesses that have already made a switch to a 4-day week, that is the model that they've used. And how that's possible is that essentially productivity goes up when people are working less. You know, I don't think many people will find it surprising to know that when you're overworked and burnt out, you become demotivated at work and don't do as well as a job. So this huge business argument for it is that productivity will go up, and that allows people to work less.
Now, what's interesting is your letter that is arguing for a 4-day work week. It says it can help countries recover from the economic impacts of the coronavirus pandemic. How would that work?
So what you've got at the moment is you've got millions of people being made unemployed, but at the same time, millions of people overemployed and working too much. And what we found in the UK anyway is that people seem to be working more hours of COVID because there's not very many checks and balances when people are working at home. And so how this works is that over history, in times of recession and crisis, shorter working hours have been implemented to share work more equally across the economy. And that rebalances the economy.
The jobs you're talking about are mostly kind of white-collar jobs. And so much of at least the U.S. economy is service. How does it apply to the service economy?
So it's definitely easier to implement for white-collar jobs, but there's no reason why it can't be implemented amongst blue-collar jobs. Let's take an example off the top of my head, someone who works in the service sector, like a cafe or a restaurant. You have to have workers there at all times, but that doesn't mean that it's not possible. It just means that you have to be a bit more clever with the shift patterns. The restaurant and cafe is always open, but that workers are also given enough time off so they're not overworked.
It almost seems too good to be true. The working less could actually improve the economy. I mean, critics say that reduced working hours would actually slow economies down and worker productivity would go down, actually. I mean, what is the evidence that that wouldn't happen?
In Japan, when Microsoft went down to a four-day working week, productivity actually went up by 40%. I know that Buffer, the social media organization in America, has just gone down to a four-day week. We've been speaking to them, and so far it seems to be working out very well. All of the work is still being done, all the targets are still being met, but yet workers are much happier and healthier and their lives aren't so dominated by work.
Joe Ryle is a campaigner for Four Day Week UK. They recently signed on to an open letter to leaders of the EU, as well as President-elect Joe Biden, calling for a four-day work week. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you.
One of the most important telescopes in the world is on the brink of collapse after two supporting cables snapped. The Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico is a popular tourist destination and an essential tool for hundreds of scientists around the world. The 900-ton platform containing the telescope could crash down unless the cables are repaired or replaced. Abel Mendez is an astronomer at the University of Puerto Rico. He uses the telescope for his research. Abel, how precarious is the situation at the observatory right now? I mean, are you worried?
Yes, I'm totally worried about the situation right now. When the first cable failed, I was not that worried because it was a smaller cable. I thought that it might take just a few months to repair. But now the second failure was one of the main cables. And now the weight of the platform, those cables have to withstand that weight where they're not built for that much weight. So that's very critical right now.
Why is the observatory so important for your research?
Well, we want to understand the impact of the radiation environment of stars. Some stars are very stable, like our sun, but other stars are very active, constantly emitting extra doses of radiation. So I have been monitoring from the Arecibo Observatory some of these active stars in the last 4 years, looking for the best stars for habitable planets.
Scientists from all over the world rely on this telescope for their work. What would the impact be if this telescope were lost?
Arecibo is still the biggest and most powerful radar in the world. This feature is used to study asteroids. So therefore, Arecibo is the best instrument to study the properties of trajectory of any potentially hazardous asteroid moving toward Earth. After you detect a new asteroid, you need to learn the properties, like the shape, the size. So that tells you how much damage it could cause if there is an impact into our atmosphere.
Thousands of tourists come to visit the Arecibo Observatory every year. Beyond its scientific significance, how important is the observatory to Puerto Ricans?
Well, the Arecibo Observatory is an icon in Puerto Rico. And it also helped many people to get involved in science careers. For example, for me, my first visit was when I was 10 years old to the observatory. I had a wonderful experience because one of those scientists there took me around the observatory and I was totally impressed. It's every picture you see of the observatory, it doesn't compare being there because it's so huge.
I know the Arecibo Observatory is asking the National Science Foundation for $12.5 million in repair funding. What is being done to stabilize the structure? And do you think at this point it can be saved?
Well, at this moment, with the information that we have, the structure is not safe. Those cables are withstanding more weight than they were built for. So I know a lot of engineers from Puerto Rico and the U.S. are observing the situation and trying to figure out how to stabilize the structure. But at this point, I don't think there is a, it's not an issue of money. No matter how much money you have, the issue is that even that if you know the solution just to build more cables, those cables take a lot of time to build. So time now is critical. I know they're trying to work as fast as they can.
Abel Mendez is an astronomer at the University of Puerto Rico. He's been speaking to us from Arecibo. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman will be back with you tomorrow.
from PRX.